Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection.
Welcome, Jamil, to the Autism Roundtable. Thank you for joining us. I'd love for you, if you can, to introduce yourself and tell us your relationship to the autism community.
Okay, so I hate this part because it sounds like I'm bragging on myself, but trust me, I am not. So when you hear everything, I've been blessed to have to be able to do everything that I'm doing. So my name is Jamil Owens. First and foremost, I'm an autism father. I also professionally am the family relations coordinator here at the Center for Autism Research at CHOP. I'm also the founder and CEO of the nonprofit organization Awesomeness Incorporated. Father, resourcer, networker, whatever you want to put. I'm author. I'm a lot of different things, but that's just me.
I love it. So we'll go through your different hats because I feel like in each one of your roles, you have a lot of different experiences that our listeners will be really interested in hearing about. So I guess we'll start with your role as a dad of a child with autism. Go ahead, tell us a little bit about the experience when you found out about his autism, what that was like.
So finding out about the diagnosis wasn't the hard part. That's, back in that day, Shane, who was my son, was diagnosed at the age of 3. So we're talking about 2012. Receiving the paperwork wasn't the issue. It was actually digesting that I now have a child with special needs and what that looks like. So I can only speak for myself and my perspective when saying any of this. So I don't want anybody to take it literal for all men or men of color. But for me as a Black man, going through a lot of different traumas in my life earlier on that had nothing to do with autism or having a child, I refuse to ingest that, in addition to what I was going through, to kind of put that on my back. I refuse to. So being transparent, I was not a part of Shane's life for the first 3 or 4 years of his existence on this planet. I was really absent. I was totally absent. And I want to be transparent with that because it is important for men to engage with their family, with their spouse, after receiving that diagnosis, more so be a servant more than an ingester or a receiver of this information. So, that was the hardest part. Coming back was even harder into Shane's life because it wasn't a mutual thing. It was a invitation off of a duress, right? So I received a phone call, and basically this is the words out of his mother's mouth, who was my wife then, and obviously we divorced. But she said, "You need to come see your son. Your son just called a trash man daddy." And that took me out 100%, where I had to go and just really embrace Shane and just like consistently kiss on him and love on him. And I promised to myself that no matter how difficult it may be, I will never abandon him like that again. So, ever since that point, I've been building up to where I'm at currently right now, being engaged with him. But now my focus is more so on the entire autism community, individuals who are just like him or who are different than him.
So I love that you're touching on the male role in a child with autism's life. Why is it important to have a dad in his life? And what regrets do you have in not being there for the first 3 years? And what positive experiences have you had now that you have joined back into his life?
Well, let me try to tackle it one at a time. If I remember it, I'm old age, so.
It's okay. I'll keep asking questions. Right. You're good.
The importance of fathers being engaged. There is a rightful balance in the nuclear family that is set up supernaturally. So it's not even something that I can say, oh, well, you know, scientists or anything. It's just a balance that is needed there. I want to be politically correct by saying this is that that balance is determined by so many different factors. But what I'm speaking about, me personally, as far as my experience, is a husband and a wife being in a mutual nuclear family, right? The strengths behind that are the affection, the role model as far as different activities, the mental and psychological effects, positive effects that it has on children growing up to know what it is to see affection, what it is to be affectionate, what it is to be supportive of a male, whether that is a strong male or a strong mom. What does that look like? What does teamwork look like? So when that person actually is growing up and looking to pursue relationships, what that actually is going to provide for them. So once again, that's just my perspective. I know there are many types of relationships out there, and I want to respect those and acknowledge those. But I'm only speaking from my part as far as being in a woman and a male household together.
Yeah, and it is so important, like you touched on, that our children see us modeling. When we model behavior of how to engage with another human, that child's taking it in and he's watching. And if we're showing toxic relationships, that's what a child's going to learn. And if we're showing positive relationships, that's what the child's going to learn. So 2020 hindsight is always easy. It's always easy to look back and say, I wish I would have done. But what advice would you give to parents in how to make it work? It is really hard and difficult having a child with special needs. So what components do you think are important for parents to focus on when trying to make a relationship work?
I mean, first and foremost, both of you have to breathe. I mean, after receiving that diagnosis, a lot of parents, a lot of caregivers don't take the time to breathe. They suddenly spring into action. Now, the reverse side of that is that you take a long breath like I did, and, you know, you're absent. You may be a functioning depressive, meaning you may just be doing the things that you need to do. But when it's you at night siloed, the kids are asleep, you're crying, you're drinking, you're doing anything to kind of get your mind off of reality. So I think the first thing is to breathe. The second thing is to be a server of or to serve your partner. Hey, you know, this was a heavy load we received today. Or if you're in the thick of it, you know what? You know, we're doing a lot that is really taxing on our mental and physical health. What can I do to kind of lighten the load up for you? So these are conversations that are very, very important. I'm learning that now with my wife, and we have a toddler, so I have a younger son. So to kind of go back and then shift right back, missing the earlier parts of Shane's life, I'm now living it now in my toddler son. So I'm seeing all of the things that I'm missing, you know, him first riding a bike, you know, to his first interaction at the aquarium, to his first interaction at the zoo, to him making his first faces or saying his first words or walking. I'm able to relive that right now. We'll talk about regrets or anything after that. But to go back to the teamwork that needs to take place, you have to breathe. The second thing is that there's no finger pointing. None. There should never be any finger pointing on who is at fault, nor should you finger point at someone who is not giving what is expected, right? So we have to set like real expectations, like something that someone can actually accomplish. You doing high expectations for a person that you marry that you know only does X, Y, and Z is setting yourself up from divorce. You married that person knowing that they can provide X, Y, and Z, or they're capable in their integrity to do these three things, right? So you have to find a way as the partner, whether it be male, female, whatever the case may be, you have to find the ability to see the strengths and the weaknesses and set the expectations along that. If you set too high expectations, your marriage is going to crumble. Your relationship is going to crumble. If you set too low, your relationship is going to crumble because you're going to feel alienated. You're going to feel like you're doing most of the legwork. what I say to men is, men, you have to be able to communicate with your wife. What that looks like, it's crazy. We can't communicate because, you know, we speak a different language, right? But you have to be able to take in what your counterpart is actually saying. Dissect it, even if it takes you 24 hours. Internalize it, dissect it, disseminate it, but come back to your partner and say, if I heard you correctly, this is what your wants are. This is where I'm lacking. Am I correct? And to the wives or to the other partners, you have to acknowledge that that person may not give you an answer right then and there, or they may give you an answer that's kind of jaded. How you respond to that is very, very important, because you don't want to leave an open-ended conversation or argument. You want to have real expectations with a end goal and a to-do list for both of you when you walk away. We didn't even touch on the child part. We're just touching on the conversations between both of you. You do those things, I guarantee you that you will stay a team and you will stay married. You will not be one of the statistics that are basically alienating this nation and this world today as we know it when it comes down to families with special needs children.
And I love that. I love your perspective. And all marriages are difficult. Marriages with a neurodivergent child is even more complicated, because there's so many more stressful moments and challenges that come into our lives. And really focusing on making sure that you communicate. And like you said, you know, like the book, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. We are different breeds, and it's a challenge, but we're all challenged by it. And there is so much support out there on how to make a marriage work. And unless we want to make the marriage work, it's not going to work. And unless we put the effort in, marriage is effort. If we don't put the effort in, we're also not going to be successful. So I love those points. And the pointing fingers point is so good, because, and I like your solution, pointing fingers helps nobody. When you put blame on somebody, it helps nobody. And you don't even mean to point the fingers. What you mean to say is that there's an issue here and we need to resolve it. And putting blame here and there is not going to resolve the issue. So really making that checklist, that is a great solution of what is the issue that we're facing here, and what are practical solutions, and who cares whose fault it really is. So I love that. Now, you also touched on the Black community and how difficult that was for you to be accepted. Would you like to expand a little bit on that and what messaging you might have for the community?
To my Black and Brown community, my brothers and sisters. So this expands starting in my community and then expands outward to every community. We have to really step up and take precedence when it comes down to visually seeing that there is an issue with our loved ones, with our children. If you see something that is causing red flags, that is causing alarm, don't overlook it. Don't push it off. I know historically the labels and the terrible things that have been done to my people throughout history kind of shuns us away from saying, okay, that's just another label to add to our children, right? But the long term, what you have to look at is what's going to happen when you're gone. So if you're seeing something that is present with your child that is affecting them socially, mentally, cognitively, you know, you have to see what is going on. Even though that may be hurtful to you, once again, subtracting the I away from this equation, you're now focusing on the development, the growth, and the success of your child, your loved one, in the future, in whatever form that may be. And it starts with you advocating. That first step is an advocate. That's you advocating for your child. So I would encourage my community to act more. And we have been. As the years have been progressing, we really have. But there are so many that still are without diagnosis. There are still many who maybe received a diagnosis still without treatment. We really need to lean in on each other to be able to support. Now, for my outside communities that are looking into the Black and Brown community, you know, we may not experience that type of resistance to it. And you have to be mindful with the language and a perspective that you give my community. When it comes down to hearing, well, why didn't she do this or why didn't they do that? You don't understand the traumas behind it. Instead, don't even worry about the reason. Just offer assistance, offer resources. That's the way that you can be of help at any assistance. And listen, sometimes it's just us wanting to vent as parents, and you just listen and give your perspective. Hey, well, you know what? I looked at it, you know, in my perspective, you know, this is what we got our child. Maybe it could help you. I don't know. But if you want help with it, I'm willing to help you out. It's just really about embracing the reality of things, what is actually having and going on. And you hear this plenty of times, but the diagnosis is not a death sentence. It's really not a death sentence. You have to really understand the framework behind the diagnosis. And also, too, on a more spiritual level, the reason why you've been blessed with this child. Now, people would be like, well, what are you talking about? It's not a blessing. Is it really, or is it really not? And I pose people to think this way is because if you did not have this child to slow you down, to capture your heart and your mind, to make you work harder for one, to serve one individual in this planet, where would you be? And a lot of people would be like, oh, well, I'll be traveling. I'll probably move somewhere. Everything that you said, focus still on I, one person. But now you are actually serving and you're giving to another person. You are literally the humanitarian that a lot of people claim on their profiles are trying to be. And you know what? That was given to you because you got a gift that's in-house that you are able to gain this perspective and these ideas on. So.
And I love that. I love that idea of needing to accept the role of being a giver, that sometimes we're not ready for it. Sometimes we're not at the point where we want to be the giver. But once we are given that gift of being a giver, we really have to assume that role and come to accept it. Would you like to share with us a little bit about your journey of accepting it and how parents could go about accepting it?
My journey as far as accepting it was a spiritual journey, a lot of different things. So before people, another spiritual lesson, is much more than that. So I at the time of diagnosis, I did not know my father. He's in my life now. We have a very good relationship. He has a very good relationship with both of my children. But I also was absent from my mom. So I was on my own since the age of 16. She kicked me out because she suffered from schizophrenia and depression. She no longer trusted me. So I was living on my own ever since 16. And what really dove into me was really the pitfalls of life, the highs and the lows, which I could never understand. But in my mindset, I was always keep going, keep going, keep going. There was a couple of times where I was challenged mentally, psychologically, put in places where I wanted to take my own life, and that never succeeded. So I always had a connection spiritually, but I never really grasped on it because my whole analysis about everything is like, well, all this bad is happening to me. I don't need to seek spirituality because why is this happening to me? I need to go out and get it. I need that hustler mentality. So that's all I was doing. But I will always end up in the same rotation where I was like close to losing everything, lost my car, close to losing my home, no money, no job. It literally, repeatedly, it was coming back until I just got on my knees one day and I was like, God, I need your help with this. And how I knew he heard me was in my past apartment, Shane's room was literally, I would say probably 50 feet away from me. And he did not know because he was in his room listening to cartoons. And I was crying. I was on my knees and I was crying. And he literally ran out of nowhere and gave me a hug.
Aww.
That's when I knew this wasn't even about the physical aspect of autism. This wasn't about the label. This was bigger than me identifying as a black male from the black and brown community. This was a spiritual battle that has been given to me in order to get me on track to what my purpose in this life was. So I started to look at that and really grow in my spirituality and say, what is it about Shane that I need to learn? And that's when I become very, that's when I was very, very invested.
That is amazing. And you really have. You have gone so far from there and you have really built yourself up to being involved in the autism community on so many levels. So let's talk about that journey a little bit. So now you're working at CHOP within the community as well. Tell us a little bit about that and what work you're doing.
You know, what I'm doing right now is basically everything that I've done since 2014. You know, in the beginning of my advocacy journey, I figured out we needed a space for men. So I started my platform, The Awesome Show. That was an online radio show, basically paid out my pocket to give, you know, autism fathers, mothers, caregivers, educators, a safe space to kind of unpack, unload a lot of the conversations that need to be happening inside the communities. And that kind of like just catapulted me into these years of advocacy work. So I will work jobs that weren't, you know, remotely close to the work that I'm doing now, but I will still do the advocacy work. So I'll work a 9-to-5 or whatever craziness I will work. And then I will go out to these events, table at these events, and tell them about the show to get more people involved. That led me up to me getting this position. And that's exactly what I do today. I basically do the same thing, going out to the public, doing outreach, connecting with the communities, but also resourcing these different organizations that have a problem tapping into these communities to find out what's going on, really keeping boots to the ground, ear to the streets, and how we can actually support them. So that's everything that I encompass on top of still keeping a podcast and everything else with my nonprofit that I'm doing.
Love that. I love that. What sort of, like, do you feel like you have fulfillment from doing community work within the autism community?
I feel like when I leave this planet, when you know, my death is announced, if there are members of the community that I've worked with, I feel like they will come to my funeral and they will be able to tell my sons, your father was a good man. Like, he helped me out. He helped my son out. He was able to connect me. He got me off the ledge. So if you ask that 100%, I am blessed to be able to get paid for it, but I work as if I'm not getting paid for it because that's the true reward.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Okay, now you're also somewhat involved with a camp for children with autism. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Camp for Kids was started by Tim and Penny, and they are amazing people, first off. Tim and Penny Morton, I'm sorry. They started this camp off years ago. I just happened to really intersect with them about, it's been 3 years. And they noticed everything that I was doing, and we built a close personal relationship, professional and personal. And, you know, I've been involved with it. I'm one of the board members that really try to help see the mission for Camp for Kids, which is they do these autism camps every, Labor Day weekend. So every Labor Day weekend, you can sign up to be a part of this camp. They take you out of whatever area you're from, bring you up to this beautiful camp for the entire weekend. They have food, games, the lodging, everything is no cost. They raise the money for this, so they're an amazing nonprofit. They also do toy drives. They do it all. They do a lot of different activities to expand the community and the livelihood of this autistic communities and those individuals who are actually diagnosed with autism. So it's been a pleasure for me to be involved, to actually use some of my marketing genius, my connections, to get them in spaces that they need to be. And this is 100% from their heart. So they don't make money from this. What they're trying to do is they're trying to give these kids a sense of life or a sense of direction in life along with their parents to kind of understand this journey, prepare them for battle on this journey. And it's a beautiful thing every single year.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really, really, really awesome. Okay, I know that you also are a certified firefighter one, and you have experience with law enforcement and how that impacts children on the autism spectrum. So I'd love for you to speak to that a little bit.
So I was a corrections officer for 18 months in the Department of Corrections in Delaware. Also a volunteer firefighter in Hatfield. I'm not active right now, the reason being because I'm doing so much with this. But through my nonprofit, me and my partner, Cheryl Steele, we are actually doing trainings for law enforcement and firefighter. And we use that experience to bring a new perspective to what training should look like. It is community-based, community-focused, and community-voiced, which means that we're not going to bore you with statistics that you can pull offline. What we're going to give you is real-life scenarios and instances that will be able to uplift you in a professional job environment that you actually work. Flip side, we actually offer the same training towards community, basically saying, hey, this is what law enforcement is asking from you. This is what first responders are asking you to do, because we feel as though, and we know this, is that the onus is not just 100% on law enforcement, first responders. It's actually also, too, on the community and how the communication and everything works together to ensure the safety of our loved ones and our young ones as well. You know, being able to give my expertise with that, being able to be in these situations where I received the training, so I'm able to see a scenario in a different light and be able to talk about this, but I'm able also to disseminate that information to the community, take what their feedback is and disseminate that to law enforcement and first responders. It's been a blessing. It's been a blessing. I mean, I can't be thankful enough for the opportunities that I've been given.
Yeah. Now, if we wanted to connect your law enforcement to parenting advice and how parents should address law enforcement to children on the autism spectrum, what are important pieces that are important for parents to share with their children prior to, say, there is a fire and, you know, that's a really scary event for a child with autism, or, you know, let's start with the fire and then we could go on to the law enforcement piece.
When you're talking about an instance of a fire, you know, tension rises. Adrenaline is pumping. It's a dire situation, right? So one thing, you have to keep calm and cool. Let's take an advantage of like firefighter talk, right? So I'm going to give you a quick rundown. You're looking at a building. The front door of the building is side A, and then you will go clockwise B, C, D. That's how firefighters know what area of the house someone is stuck in. You have to have a game plan. So what's your fire escape plan? Please, if you tell me, hey, you know, I have a child that's nonverbal or verbal, let me let you know something. Even though they're non-speaking or speaking, which is the better terminology for that, they still can hear, unless they have a co-occurring condition in which they're deaf. But you still have to teach that child or have a plan in place where another member of the family is able to successfully get to that person and get them out. But if not, what are the practices that need to be in place at home? Have your doors closed, buy you, you know, further time. Have that fire safety plan in play. Practice what you're going to say to first responders when they arrive on scene. Run these things through your head so that it flows out seamlessly. When those first responders get on the scene, they're able to gather that information from you, get in the building, get everybody out, and extinguish that fire. Now, people might say, it's not as easy as it seems. I get it 100%, but practice makes perfect, or perfect practice makes perfect, right? So you have to be able to start these conversations and fix those things that are falling apart along those practice routes, right? And that's what we're here for. That's what a community is supposed to do. But it starts with you, because you know your house, you know your family, you know your journey. We just need to help you make sure that you facilitate it in the right way. Law enforcement. When it comes to law enforcement, first thing is, you know, there's these ID cards and so many different things. First off, don't be grabbing for anything in front of a law enforcement officer. You have to understand the use of force continuum. It's public knowledge. You can look it up on the internet. If you look at that, then you'll understand the reason why you don't want to do things like that. Well, let's talk about children or adults with autism that may elope or maybe have that fight or flight, occurrence when it comes to an interaction. Okay. That's fine. Are you attaching anything as far as an identification onto that child? If they are responsive or able to comprehend that law enforcement is stopping them, are you teaching them to keep their hands in a visible place and to consistently tell the officer to contact you, telephone number, name, and address if possible? These are the three pieces of information, or they can say, hey, I have information about who I am in my pocket. Can I reach for it? Once again, our children are not incapable of doing these things. There are certain levels of autism, which obviously allows different means of supports. And there is also a different way we can approach every single level if we sit down and have these initial conversations. And then for the last and most important, EMS, ambulance services, okay? Getting to the place, you want to make sure, and for all of them, that you're mentioning on the 911 call, this is an autistic person. This is a person who has been diagnosed with autism with any other co-occurring conditions, because 9 times out of 10, that information will not be disseminated on the CAT system. It is vital information to help that first responder adhere to a situation.
Yeah, because if we come into the need of law enforcement, they come into our home for whatever reason it is that's necessary, preparing a child to make sure that that child doesn't act out or feels comfortable and safe is like super important. So I love all those ideas as far as like how we could prepare them. I liked your idea as well about putting name, address, and making sure our children are safe if they do elope or if they find themselves away from their parents and need to find them. So I love all this awareness that you are bringing to these topics. Amazing. Okay, so you have a lot of experience in all of these areas. If you had to give like a positive message to parents or a piece of information that you feel parents could really, really benefit from, what would it be?
I'll just say this and leave it like this. You are enough. You are enough for this journey. You are enough for this fight. You are enough for you. You're enough for your spouse. You're enough for any battle or obstacle that comes into this world. As long as you're watching this, you're hearing this, you woke up this morning, you breathe, whether it can be a $12 million mansion or a $60 rental unit, you are enough. What you do with your life is going to determine on how you serve other people. And it may not make sense now, but once you are able to wholeheartedly in your heart serve other people, whether it be directly your children, your spouse, your family members, then you'll start to unpack the happiness that life actually has for you.
Thank you, Jamil, so much for joining us on this podcast. Really, you had a lot of wonderful thoughts and ideas, and I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your information with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.